Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to being a Coppola or Coppola in a Brooker's era. My name is Ryan Ritchie. I'm the founder of theflux.tv. Basically, on The Flux, we're featuring short films. And if you forget everything else from this panel today, please remember that The Flux is the number one 0.8 millionth most popular website, according to Alexa.com. Okay. So what we're going to talk about today is those of us who are creating short form content, short narrative content, how can we get that content out and get it to an audience online? And then also people who are making feature films, how can you best promote those films? So to my right is, to my left, you're right, is Alex Delisle, the managing editor of thedailyreel.com. And we have Mary Hodder, the CEO of dabble.com. And on the end, filmmaker Joe Swanberg of Hannah Takes the Stairs fame, which debuted last night.
Fame? Did you say fame?
Fame. Fame. You're becoming a fixture here at South by Southwest. Also, Joe's responsible for the pre-rolls before the films this year. So if you check out any of the films, kudos to you on that, Joe.
Thanks.
So obviously, video on the web, I'm told, is rather big right now. And the big, the 800-pound gorilla is YouTube, but the kind of content we're talking about isn't necessarily getting the exposure that we wish it would on that kind of site. So I guess the first question I would have to the panel would be, what is the state of short-form narrative online, and how do people find it?
Well, I think the short answer is it's good, it's healthy, it's there. And it's there in mass quantity, which I think is a good thing and a bad thing for the short-form filmmaker. I mean, at this point, you know, there are 200,000 videos uploaded to YouTube every day. Most of them are, you know, people with their cats or people filming, you know, something off TiVo and putting it up there. But, you know, there's a strong and robust community of people who are making content and they want to get it seen. So, you know, the question really is, you know, if you're acting as a filter, as the Daily Reel does, or as Dabble does, how do you find good stuff? And it's not it's not easy, but there's so much good stuff that I think, you know, as we move forward, there's more availability to the online filmmaker to get their stuff seen.
And so that content is out there, but how do people necessarily, you know, you say how the Daily Reel acts as a filter. I don't think very many people wake up in the morning and say, you know, I really want to go online and find some short-form narrative to watch today. And so one question I would have is, how large is the audience for the kind of content we're talking about? Is the, you know, are we all chasing this small group of people who don't really care to see it? Maybe it's a, you know, square peg in a round hole. It's not really the best venue for it.
Well, I would say a couple things. First of all, I know a bunch of people out here, and I feel completely sort of ridiculous that we're the only ones talking about this. I feel like this should be more of a discussion because there's all these people out there who actually are doing what we're talking about, and you know. So anyway, but that said, there's a couple things. First of all, there are actually a ton of people that get to work. We have this enormous slice of our traffic coming in during the workday. Like, no one's actually working at work. They're just watching video. So that's the first piece, is that I do think a lot of people have now built into their day watching video online. It's obviously not as much as people watch TV, but that's shifting quickly. And so, therefore, it's really early, and I think you're asking for sort of a sociological analysis on something that's like just beginning. And so we don't really know how it's all going to pan out. But I think, based on the way that I see people behave and the usability work that we do, that people really like watching video online. They get so much control compared to the format and the machine that is the TV, which is, for me, totally stupid. I watch a lot of TV. I just watch it on my computer because I have control. So, but the filtering question for me is really, you know, I guess my feeling about it is, if you have one single point of, taste determination, you know, whether it's dig or stumble upon or whatever, where you're just getting this single view, you're going to get this lowest common denominator kind of view. So I don't worry so much right now in this early stage that, you know, we're all going to be only ever watching a dig-like universe of, you know, I don't know. I'm sorry. It's offensive, but farting videos, I mean, are not interesting to me. And that's like a, I don't know, you know, the fraternity boy sort of mentality, to use the stereotype, is not interesting. And for me, and so, and it wouldn't be interesting to my parents, and it wouldn't be interesting to most of my friends. So how do we find interesting video? We usually get it through recommendations, either going to sites like the Flux or, going to, you know, using other people as really good filters. You find something out, you email it to somebody. In Dabble, we're building filters where people can make recommendations. There are other sites that have, you know, good recommendation tools. There's the concept of groups, where, you know, VodPod and Magnify and Splashcast are making places where people can get together because they are interested in a topic and they can filter for each other. A particular interest, you know, there someone's really into cooking and they want to find how, you know, a how-to video on making chocolate sauce. And that's not going to be at the top of the dig thing, but it might be a great video. Mm-hmm. And if you have that need, then you can find it in that group. And I think, you know, I sort of think that's where we are right now.
So from the content viewer side, it basically sounds like there's a consensus on some sort of filtering, be it community-based filtering or, mm-hmm. you know, the example we were giving before we came out here, thinking about this was fly fishing. And you could go to a community of fly fishermen or women to find out, fisher people, to find out where to go fishing. Or you could ask an expert in fly fishing, you know, and either approach isn't necessarily wrong. I think that's, you know, some of the differences between the sites on the panel. Now, that's for content viewers. From a content creator standpoint, and I guess I would look at Joe on this one, there's so much internet video. How do you use it, and where do you draw the line to stop? I mean, you and I both know of projects where people become film promoters rather than filmmakers.
Yeah, sure. Well, I've been lucky enough to plug into sort of pre-existing channels that already have an audience. I guess it's like sort of the web equivalent of doing a show for a network or something like that. Like I make my show for nerve.com, which already has a viewership. And so, you know, I don't have to do that promotion. I just get to make the show, and then they, you know, that's their job then to bring traffic to their site. And then also I've had a short film on Walfin, that DVD mm-hmm. magazine that McSweeney's does, you know, which also has sort of already a viewership. And so, you know, that's the most traditional route, but it's also, I think, still the easiest route because, those sites spend time, forming a niche for themselves and building that audience. And so if you're creating work that already fits with the kind of stuff their audience is looking for, then, you know, you found a home and you found people to watch your stuff.
So you're not necessarily yourself out there trying to push the trailers for your films on YouTube or MySpace or something
that's,
like that.
I mean, that's sort of where film festivals come in and things like, you know, like mm-hmm. I don't have any marketing money or anything like that. So, yeah, I am. I mean, I make postcards for the movies and I show them around and I do try and drive people to the websites. But not in a way yet where I'm creating original content that's like the whole point of it. Like the website is to promote the feature film. It's not, you know, like the trailer that I make for it isn't the thing you're supposed to watch. That's the thing you're supposed to watch to get excited about the other thing. So.
And also for content creators, by the way, Mary had mentioned earlier that there are probably some great ideas out there, and I do want to leave a lot of time for Q&A, but also more of a discussion as a group here, what we can come up with for solutions for getting these short form films out there. From a content creator standpoint, you know, there are sites like Rever and Blip that have a model in which the content creators are making pennies per click, as it were. And does that matter? I mean, as a content creator, is that so little that it's not even worth it? I mean, maybe you can talk a little bit about your deal with Nerve and how that all came together, and whether you think that might be the way to go in the future.
Sure. Yeah. No, I don't think a pennies per click isn't worth it. In fact, getting paid for anything you make video related, like even if it was 5 cents, you've already made 5 cents more than most people will ever make. So any model that sends money back to you, I think is a worthwhile model. And especially, if the reason you're creating the content is for some other motive, like what we were kind of talking about before, you know, like maybe the thing you're looking for is a Hollywood feature film deal down the road. And so you're creating web content because you want to generate an audience for your stuff so that you can later convince somebody to give you money. So you know, it even depends on what the point of making the content is in the first place. If all you want to do is make cool 5-minute shorts and that's, you know, as far as you want to take it, then you want to get paid for those shorts. If what you want to do is make feature films, you know, 5 years from now, then maybe you don't care that you're spending your own money to create them as long as people are seeing them.
And Alex, a big part of your audience is industry insiders in LA. What are they looking for? What do you think they're looking for in this short form content? And what do they want to do with it ultimately?
Well, I think there's two big categories as far as what they're looking for in a content creator. I think, you know, in the beginning, especially, it was more, you know, looking at online content as a new breeding ground for talent to bring over to mainstream media. So, you know, signing someone to a TV deal and giving them a feature film, things like that. But I think the more interesting question now is, you know, what do we do with these people who have proven to be commercially successful and to continue to create good short form online content? How do we, you know, bring in a sponsor, or, you know, just do we just put a banner ad over that, or do we integrate a product into the film? You know, what if the content creator doesn't want to do that? They just want to keep their vlog. How do we address, how do we as, you know, agents, managers, production companies, monetize that content? And it's, you know, there isn't an answer yet, but I think as the eyeballs keep coming to those sites, there's a real interest there. And I think it's up to the content creators to know what they want to do and to stay true to that, because, you know, it's a different medium, online content. It's not a feature film. It's a whole different animal, and I think it's a good animal, but it needs to be worked out.
And I think online shorts, it's becoming more of a destination in itself. I know when we launched our site here 2 years ago, people would say, cool, how can I get my film up there? And now they say, well, cool, how do I get paid? And, well, you don't. But that's just because, you know, of the types of models where we're talking about the pennies per click and everything. As a panel, do you think that you can make your living today as creating short films online, or is it just a stepping stone to something else? Or in the case of a lot of these creators, you know, they're not looking at it from a financial incentive at all.
So. I actually think there are a lot of people who are a fair number of people, and it's happened much faster since, you know, hosters came online 2 years ago. There were 3 hosters. And now there's 300. So in the last 2 years, with, you know, the sort of, you know, explosion of watching these clips online, there have been, you know, fairly quickly a lot of people who are making some money, some reasonable amount of money. I mean, Zay Frank, I think, makes a few thousand every month hosting his videos at Rever, and doing the revenue split. And the Mentos and Coke guys, by the end of December, had made $100,000 on the first video that they put out of the, you know, the Mentos and Coke thing. And, you know, Amanda Congdon has a 6-figure deal with Dove, sponsoring her show for a year. And, you know, and Rocket Boom is making money, and there's all these different video blogs or whatever that are doing really interesting things. The Ask a Ninja guys are making money. So it's, you know, and this is really early. And so the thing that's really interesting to me is, I think there's a couple of opportunities here. One is, if we apply the view that we've had of, you know, that, or that broadcasters and advertisers have had for, advertising to the web, it's just going to be a miserable failure, because it's a broadcast model, and the web isn't broadcast. It's one to one. It's many to many. they're more personal relationships. I mean, if you put Zay Frank's head like this on like a giant movie screen, it would just freak everyone out. No one would ever watch it. And the same thing with the ads. I mean, like, it's a different format. It's a different genre. And the advertising can be more contextually matched to people's interests. I mean, I don't want to see, you know, an ad for foot cream next to like Zay Frank's blog. Like, I have no interest in that. I'm not buying any foot cream and I don't want to see it. Not that he's done it, but I'm saying that like, but there's an opportunity there to contextually match things that matter to me with the content that I'm watching and without violating people's privacy. So that's one piece. And the advertising network that figures out how to make that match really well, they're going to win this. And it's not going to happen if some advertising companies, which are all right now trying to do this, just say, let's apply the broadcast model online, because we don't work that way online. So that's the first thing. Get in sync with that culture and maybe you'll win. The other thing is that right now TV, for each 30-second ad, the average per user revenue is 30 cents. And so that's a $300 CPM for that ad. And we don't do that online right now, except in a few cases. Blip has negotiated a couple things like that for their video bloggers, very specific, contextually matched sponsorships. But otherwise, we haven't really seen that yet. So the point is, if we can get to a place where we're getting $300 CPMs because we're really contextually matching in the many-to-many model, well, that underwrites, you know, some amazing content. Like, you have money there to do really high-quality productions, high production value kinds of things. So, again, it's early. We'll figure that out. I think people will be able to support themselves and create in this place. We're just, you know, $1 CPMs, which is the most that YouTube can charge, is just stupid. You know, I think it's ridiculous. But they don't know who their users are, and they're doing the broadcast model where you have to know your demographic, and then all you can charge is 10 cent CPM, $1 CPM. That doesn't even support the hosting, much less the creator.
And so Zay Frank, as an example, is doing okay. But, you know, it's not the same kind of content that, say, Joe might create. And so I'm wondering, do you need to tailor the content to the web? There are so many great short films, especially at this festival this year. I don't know if you've had a chance to check them out. But even if they were online, they wouldn't get that kind of viewership, you know, that, say, Zay Frank does. And so I'm wondering, Well, I
mean, is it because we don't have good enough tools to expose, to match content that people who don't want to watch farting videos would like to see with the content? And I think that's actually, you know, so I think it's on people who create tools, and me included, to do a better job to do that. And then on the other side, to figure out how to make the content work for the medium in the culture that is online content.
But also, I mean, there's just not enough time in the day to watch all that stuff.
No, not at all. 200,000 videos, like even 1%, that's completely ridiculous.
I mean, even as good as the filtering technology, you know, like even people who come here to this festival and take work off for a week and, you know, spend all their day watching it and miss a lot of the films they want to see. So,
By the way, this
talk to them.
Yes, we're going to. This panel will be available as a podcast on southbysouthwest.com, which you're all in this room, so I'm not sure why you'd want to relive it. But there is, when we get to the Q&A, there is a mic over there, so if you could use that so the folks who do watch the podcast could hear it, that'd be great. It's like a little commercial break there, a mid-roll click, and we all get 3 cents up here. The content you're creating for Nerve, Joe, is that content, tell folks a little bit about that. It's an ongoing series.
Sure.
And is that something that could have been in a different venue, like a festival, or did you kind of tailor it to being online with a single sponsor?
Well, the show's called Young American Bodies, and it was always meant to be on even Nerve specifically. I made a film called Kissing on the Mouth that was here at this festival 2 years ago, and Nerve interviewed me about that film, and during that interview I sort of pitched them the idea of doing a show on their site, because I'd been to their site and they don't have video content. They didn't at the time. And And so I said, what would you guys think about it? Because you have photo blogs and you have, you know, you pay photographers to, you know, use some of their work, and you hire people to write essays, and you do film reviews and all this kind of stuff, but nobody's making video for your site. And they were also thinking about that on their end too. And so the timing worked out right where, you know, I said, you know, you guys like this film, and, but, you know, I don't want to put an 80-minute film just available for download on your site. Let me make something new that's episodic, that's 5 minutes long, that you know, runs like a soap opera kind of. And so, you know, it originated as an online project, and it's, you know, actually I'm, you know, sort of surprised that it took me that long to finally do something like that, because I've wanted to for a really long time. So we started making it about a year ago, the first season. And so we did 12 episodes, and they started running in May, and they did it, you know, like a TV show. A new 5-minute episode would run each week, with the same characters. It continued over. And, so we did 12, and now we're doing season 2 right now, which we're doing 8 more episodes. And the first episode of season 2 just went up on Friday. And you know, it's a great show to make. It's a lot of fun. I'll keep doing it as long as they want to keep doing it, because while I'm doing the feature films that play at festivals and are sort of available on DVD, it's a really nice project that's got sort of, almost instant feedback. I mean, with the feature film, like Hannah Takes the Stairs that just premiered last night, I started making that back in July, and I finished it in November, and only last night did people finally see it. Whereas with the web show, I'm there's episodes that I'm editing on Sunday night that then thousands of people are watching Monday morning. So I really like that quality of producing work and then having it be automatically available.
3 features in the web series. Not bad for a guy staying under the radar. Oh. As you said.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's still, I mean, that's the thing about it though. It's like the audience is still, it's getting bigger, but it's still relatively small. I mean, I'm certainly not making a living doing any of this stuff. I'm still probably losing money doing it. So I have other jobs and things like that, but also that's okay with me. I'm not creating the stuff because I want to make money off of it. I'm doing it because I like doing it. So.
And the same year that Kissing on the Mouth premiered here at South by Southwest, there was another film called Four-Eyed Monsters. Anybody familiar with that?
Yes, that's great.
It's a very good film, and I wonder how great Susan and Aaron's next film would be. I'm sorry, I didn't even know you were there. how great their next film would be. But since that film was created, they have essentially become film promoters, and yeah, they do the podcast every week, and they have the MySpace and all that stuff. And do you draw the line?
And I give them a hard time about it all the time. Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't know. I was in New York not long ago, and I was walking around with Aaron, and I was like, what's going on, man? Like, I made a bunch of more movies since then, and you're still promoting this thing. And he's like, I know. I want to make another thing. But the problem is they got themselves deep into debt with that movie, which is also something that I've never done. I mean, you know, like, I keep the expenses low on all the projects because I don't want to end up in that situation that I have to spend 3 years promoting a project because, you know, I'm $50,000 in debt because of it. So I think that, creating work online, you have to be realistic. If you're going to be getting paid pennies per click, you probably don't want to take out a big loan and spend $100,000 in a year of your life making that thing. Sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, actually, I had a question for you. My name's Demar from howdoisaythis.com. We're making short form narrative on our site. And I was wondering about your production model. If you could talk, you say you did 12 episodes. Did you shoot them all at the same time? Are you doing them as it goes along? I know we're like filming something, editing it, and posting it online, and just like keep going.
Yeah, me too, kind of. It depends. Like, there's certain situations where we have actors that, you know, we can only get for a couple days, and then we kind of have to shoot a whole season's worth of stuff with them. And then there's other situations where we're sort of plugging it in as we go. The first season we started shooting in late January, and we were shooting it all the way until June. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's a, I would probably prefer to keep the production windows smaller than that. But also I learn from the projects as I'm making them, and I had never done anything episodic like that before. So I was hesitant to shoot an entire season's worth of stuff and then figure out if it worked. It was a lot easier for me to kind of do an episode at a time and let the story grow that way. I felt safer doing that. Now with season two, now that I know the characters better and it's easier for me to visualize how episodes fit together, we're able to shoot it quicker.
Given the title of the panel, we sort of took a shot at Brookers, but there are people getting deals in mainstream media from what they're doing online, be it from video blogs or what have you. But it doesn't seem like right now, maybe it's just too early, but it doesn't seem like we really hear anything from them. It's almost like they're kept in a room somewhere and not allowed to do anything. I mean, what is the industry looking for in this new talent?
Well, I think Brookers maybe isn't the best example because she hasn't really translated her talent yet to either a different medium or something online. But my favorite example is, I don't know if anyone's familiar with Lisa Nova, a.k.a. Lisa Donovan. She was a big YouTube star for a while and was actively pursued by several sites, including my own, and sought out as like a very talented sketch comedian and filmmaker. And at the time, she was doing corporate videos and things, so she was making a living off some kind of video. But you know, the big break for her was a transition into being a cast member on Mad TV, and that's, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that's like a huge leap from your career to working in corporate video to, you know, starring on national television. So she's a good example. The guys who do Chad Vader, I don't know if anyone's familiar with them. It's a pretty funny series. They're working on something now. They got signed to William Morris, I think. So there are examples of people who, you know, are working on things. And I think, you know, once you get signed and kind of scooped up, it takes a while to really put something out between all the red tape and, you know, just thinking of a good idea. But I definitely see, you know, people who get kind of snatched up really, you know, creating something really good in the next couple months. I feel like the floodgates will open and there will be a lot of like really great content coming out.
Hi, Alex Williams of Splashcast. And I'm really curious about your guys' views on why video bloggers, use them as an example, you know, should sign with a big media company. You know, what's the value for them? You just stated that there's a lot of red tape with the big media companies, and you may not be actually producing anything for quite some time. Mm-hmm. And if you're not producing anything for quite some time, that's, you know, that can't help. I mean, if you're down and if you're producing every day or every week, and then you're down for 3 months, 6 months, you know, in that time frame, there's going to be a lot of new people who are going to be coming into the space. Sure. And a lot of people are going to be increasingly recognized. And so why should you hire a media company? And also I wonder why, if it's obvious, you know, that it's changing so quickly and the distribution is so wide open, as Mary, you know, has said before, that why would you want to go to the big media companies when there are more opportunities to actually make a decent living? Maybe you won't be starring in like a big budget feature film, but you might be able to afford your rent, buy a house, you know, you may put some money away for your child's education. I mean, just basic things in life. So I'm just curious, you know, why?
I think it varies from deal to deal. I think, you know, if you go in and you're creating content in the hopes of being seen and, you know, doing a feature film, I think, you know, obviously if someone calls from William Morris or CAA, you want to go with that deal. But, you know, there are certain people, I don't really have a specific example offhand, but people who get snatched up and then they're just kind of sitting there for a while because of exclusivity deals. And, you know, if you're someone who you already have a pretty vibrant audience and they're expecting content from you regularly and then you disappear for 3 months, that kind of deal might not be in your best interest. But, you know, again, it depends on, are you trying to earn a living? Are you trying to be the next Coppola? It really, you know, it's about what you want and what your long-term goals are.
Well, I don't know. I'm sort of skeptical of agents and agencies and sort of them coming in and buying out all this new talent. I mean, part of what I'm so excited about making work online is that my show is right next to farting videos and that there's not a line between those things. That's really interesting to me. And I'm afraid of that going away. I don't like the web content becoming just like TV content because TV content sucks. So, I don't know. I would encourage people to stay independent and make less money.
I think that that's a really interesting question because it doesn't just relate to creating on the internet. It's kind of like the question since the beginning of time, you know, and are you selling out if you take money and blah, blah, blah. I think you're selling out if you let go of your ideals and or your standards, not if you take money. People have to pay their rent and it's really hard to make film or video content. It's a lot of work. And I think it's really, my own view is that I can't make any, you know, whatever anybody else feels, whatever, but I can't make any judgments against anybody who wants to, earn a living, save up money for their child's education, pay the rent. I mean, but I definitely make judgments about creators who, you know, stop doing good stuff and start doing schlock because they feel that's the only way that they can make money. I think that's the sellout. And so I don't think it's a bad thing. I also don't really have an issue with people going away for 3 months. I mean, I'm not so, I don't know. I don't forget people who existed online 3 months ago. And I also think that it's really hard to always be fresh and create new content, and taking a 3 month hiatus can actually be incredibly rejuvenating as a creator. I don't think it's a bad thing at all. So.
Hi. I think there's a lot of kind of film student or like short festival type of content creators that are putting a lot of time into their, you know, short film masterpieces. And then looking for a way to get them seen, upload them, and are getting really frustrated that, you know, people are more interested in people with cats and farting videos than, you know, their little mini Coppola epic. Do you think that that's just kind of a square peg in a round hole? Or, are there types of content that you wish, you know, you could steer these people towards creating that would be more viable online? Or do you think that it's just a problem with not getting the, you know, trouble getting the audience to those things, but there are people out there looking for that?
I think the short film is a really tough example because, you know, there's online, you only have a certain amount of time to watch something. And I think everyone in this room would agree that, you know, something that might be really engaging in a theater doesn't really play so well on your little, you know, 300 by 250 box on your computer. That said, I think, you know, it really comes down to the story, and I know that kind of sounds trite, but you know, if you're creating a short film that can capture someone in the first few seconds, and you know, it doesn't have to be flashy or you know that high production value, but the stuff that you continually see, you know, making the rounds. I don't know if anyone's familiar with the Web 2.0 video. It's been going around. It's just this like it's like a kind of an animation that goes through like the structure of the internet, and it's kind of a little bit philosophical, but that's something that, you know, is different, and you don't really see, you might see it at a short film festival, but it's not your typical short film with a beginning, middle, end. So, you know, creating something different, which is obviously a difficult thing to do, is always going to get you attention. I think the short films that play well online are really short. Like, anything over 5 minutes is probably not going to take off online because people only have, you know, especially the people that are at work, don't have a lot of time to watch it. So, you know, the short, the snappy, and hooking people in is important.
That's great. I think we should, like, I'm going to make a tag, like, creating for the work audience. Creating for people who are goofing off in the office.
Well, that's a lot of eyeballs, you know.
Well, and since it is a lot of eyeballs, when Joe, for example, when you're working on Young American Bodies, even though you knew it was going to be on the web, is there anything from a production standpoint that you do differently with that in mind?
But actually it's the way that I've been shooting sort of from the beginning. But yeah, I mean, I'm very conscious of the photography, knowing that the people are going to be seeing it really small. But actually, one of the nice things about it is that most video cameras, the LCD screen is actually a pretty nice live version of how big it's going to end up being anyway. So I shoot for the LCD screen and make sure that it looks good there, knowing that that's probably close to what it's going to look like. But yeah, I mean, I use a lot of solid colors and you know, I'm conscious of compression and a lot of, you know, how it's going to translate before people finally see it.
One thing that I noticed when ABC started putting their videos online was that they would cut, you know, they would take like a half an hour show. And when they make things for a larger TV, right, they would do all these establishing shots that would be really pulled back and huge, right? You know, like think like Dallas or something, or I don't know what TV shows are. I haven't watched TV in like 7 years, so I don't know. What 24. 24 is a good example because I've downloaded all of those from iTunes. So they have these giant establishing shots, right? And we're used to that on TV, but for that teeny little screen, like you can't even see what it is. So what ABC recut and made these little mini webisodes of their TV shows that were running on TV. And they took all those out because no one could tell what they were anyway. And they just kept all the really close up shots, kind of the Zay Frank version of Desperate Housewives or whatever. And, it was really interesting. Like right away, they got it that this wasn't going to work. They were going to have to redo it to make it work in this little format. And I thought that was kind of cool for, you know, ABC.
My question kind of follows along on this. My husband is a filmmaker and also curates a short film program at our local art house theater in Ann Arbor, the Michigan Theater. And I help him find stuff. I'm a web designer, and so I'll find stuff out on the web. And I say, you gotta get these people. We'll show it at the next Cinema Slam. And are there ways that those of us who have access to real world, you know, brick wall venues help filmmakers get stuff online and offline? Because some of what we end up showing that I've found online gets to audiences that would have never seen it because they'd never find it mm-hmm. online. Do you have any thoughts on how we can collaborate to make that work better? Or is it onesie twosie just doing it like this?
I think to some extent, yeah, because you're talking about, I mean, I don't know how I would do that because I don't know a lot of people that do what you do, but maybe you guys.
Are you talking about theatrical distribution or just offline?
For this is pretty small. This is, you know, a nonprofit theater that is just getting stuff out there and so has, you know, an arts mission of sorts. But it does give us a chance to advance the short film form as narrative short film.
I think it all feeds into each other. I think, you know, it's why I'm doing both things. You know, it's why I'm making films that play festivals and play in theaters, and also why I'm excited about producing work that's online. And even though it's not this, even though the productions aren't the same thing, I think they lead to each other. And people who like my web show seek out the features, and people who like the features go watch the web show. So, yeah.
I know for our site, we often do it the other way, that we'll look for film. We've partnered with film festivals and we take the shorts and say the top three shorts automatically come to the site then. So
there are actually, now that I think about it, I've programmed like four or five conferences in the last year and a half where like in between people speaking, they'll have a screen like that and they'll show videos. And so I'll just give them like 200 videos to show over the 3 days and then they'll just play them in between. And I think that's actually good exposure because a lot of the people who come to those haven't seen them. And that, I mean, that's one way of doing what you're describing.
We'd mentioned earlier, some of the differences in doing the production for quote unquote, the small screen and the LCD being the right, you know, basically this is the right size, but isn't that something that's transient? I mean, is technology improves and things like Juiced and things like that come online for full screen. Is that going to matter? And especially with YouTube, I find we get a lot of pushback from people who are concerned about the quality of their clips. People who are really making short films just aren't happy with the way they look online on some of the bigger sites. So as that goes away, do you think we might start to see more of this great short form content that now is only at festivals?
Well, what makes you think the poor quality is going away? I mean, YouTube is, you know, with Google buying them, they're, because socially within Google, apparently, and I just know this from talking to the engineers, it's like this hang your head mode of like, you know, we blew it. And so we had to buy YouTube. And so they're going with everything YouTube. And so everything from Google Video is being moved over, but the Google Player is so much better. I mean, technically, Google just, you know, kicked ass over YouTube, but YouTube won, and they had the lowest common denominator Flash version, and, you know, it's terrible quality, and all the Google Video, like all those BBC documentaries that you can watch in a full screen view because the Google Player is really good, are going to be, you know, recoded in a lower standard and played in the YouTube Player, which I just think is horrible. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's, I think there's actually a number of reasons why creators should never put their videos on YouTube. And one of the reasons is because the license says that when you upload, if you're uploading your own stuff, I mean, obviously this doesn't apply for stuff that people have pirated, but if you upload your own stuff, you're giving a commercial reuse license to the whole web. And if you're a creator, do you want to do that? Like,
I don't care.
You don't care?
I just want people to see this stuff. Remix or take it or
charge someone for it somewhere else or any of that. Like, you don't care. I think a lot of people do. I think they would rather go to Blip or Rever where they get to retain more control and set the licensing themselves and have, you know. So I think that's a really good reason not to put your stuff at YouTube. And then the quality is really ridiculously terrible.
Yeah, the quality is bad, but I don't think there's any room for quality snobs anymore, especially on, like, I think there are those people, and I mean, even at
I don't know. I like it when the sound is in sync with the video. Call me crazy. I don't know. I mean, I would rather see your stuff in with the sound, like, and the video matched up. I mean,
I think it's a different aesthetic, though. Like, I think people online, because you're watching it in these short little chunks, and you're kind of more interested in what you're seeing than how it necessarily looks. I think, you know, and it's a good thing for content creators because you don't have to, you know, pour $25,000 into your short film the way you used to. You know, you can be a little breezier with your style and a little more laid back. And I think, you know, it ends up looking good. And, you know, some people are really into cinematography, but some people just want to, you know, show that they're really funny or show that they can tell a story or that they can make
well, and it's like it's like music or something like that. I mean, you know, you could set up a living room with a really nice sound system and say that you could sit there and fully appreciate the quality of the music. But if you hear a song at a club with a million people talking around you, you don't say that, like, oh, well, I didn't fully experience that song.
Well, it's not, I'm not saying that it has to be like high art or high art quality at YouTube, but I'm just saying that it's not very good, and I'd rather go with Flash at other sites. Flash is like the MP3 of, you know, video, and it's not great quality. I don't mind Flash. It's just, I kind of mind just going to the absolute lowest common denominator.
Yeah.
I often wonder if when we talk about the key length being, you know, 3 minutes or 5 minutes, how much of that might be the small size and the bad quality and not necessarily attention spans. So. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Robin Benefield with DiscoveryChannel.com, and I guess I have a question about whether or not you think video that's been created for the web should appear on air. Discovery Channel recently did a spoof show where they asked people to send in spoofs of their shows, and it was created into a clip show and then aired. And we ran into a lot of logistical issues. You know, of course, the video they submitted didn't have, you know, the same kind of television quality. You had to go back and ask them for, you know, so I just kind of wanted to think from kind of a creative and logistical standpoint, if you think that's something that should be tried or continued, you know, or, you know, what you think, how can you marry kind of the online video experience with what happens on air?
I know a number of companies who are working to kind of curate online video offline. Like TiVo, I know, is doing a few deals, and Verizon, their new broadcast channel. And I think, you know, the web to TV technology isn't all there yet, having dealt with it personally. But I think that, you know, the short stuff does work on TV. I mean, you can watch something like Best Week Ever, you know, shows like that that are just like a barrage of clips, and you know, you can it does take off offline. So I think, you know, that once the infrastructure to deliver that kind of stuff in those venues is there, I think there's definitely people that want to watch it. You know, and eventually, you know, it's all going to be in one place anyway, so might as well be in your living room.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I mean when I talk about quality snobs or anything like that. It's it's quality is subjective anyway, and I think that the content creators are a lot more conscious of how it originated than the end viewer, as far as like how good it could look versus how good it does look. And you know, it becomes about whether the video is interesting or not. And, you know, you can make your stuff available in different ways too. Like, you can put it up on YouTube on their crappy player, but you can also put it up like a really nice encoded QuickTime on your own site or something. You know, like, that's the other nice thing. It can exist in multiple, versions at once of varying qualities, I think. And bandwidth's so cheap now, you know. I mean,
hey, I'm Jason Shallon. I'm actually with Google, and I wanted to just talk for just a moment about some of the things that Mary was talking about, and then an actual question. One of them is that Google's all about like tuning things and getting them right over time. So some of the things that you said about the video player, video quality, things like that, I don't know if those are necessarily true. I think eventually. Google does the right thing. So I'd wait for the next iteration and let them know. Google's pretty good about listening to things like that.
I was like, please keep your player.
That's good. That's good. We need to hear things like that. So the other thing is that, what happened to worse is better. You know, VHS over beta. There are people who, you know, still shoot on beta. I think this is the format thing. You can go back and forth. HTML, we wouldn't all be here if, you know, HTML hadn't won. I'm not an SGML expert. There are like, you know, all sorts of formats. But the thing I did want to talk about is that the one thing that YouTube does seem to be very good at is, you know, just that disbursement and distribution, things like that. So if I were a filmmaker, I would leverage the heck out of that too. You know, even if it's just promotional. You talked about the ABC player, you know, where they actually recut things and tailor it to the format. Now, if you're a small filmmaker, maybe you don't have time to do that. You can just upload what you have. But it seems like that embeddable thing that you talked about, the copyright, yeah, you're getting distribution not only on YouTube, but like any blog that likes your thing as well. So maybe don't put the full content, put part of it. An argument for partial, I guess is what I'm saying. So how do you feel about that? How do you feel about that argument for partial? Or do you like to see your work in its form and you don't want, you know, promos and coming up Friday night?
I think promos are good. I mean, I think it's great. And the other thing, like I know what you're saying about the spending 3 years of promoting Four-Eyed Monsters, but I like that they've chopped it up into pieces and that we get these little stories about how they did things and what they did. I think webisodes and around the making of is really interesting. And then you can also go and watch the movie. I like that myself.
One thing I want to clarify, and this is something that I think has changed over the past 6 months. It used to be that you would just put your clip up on YouTube and then it would, you know, have some sort of viral growth and people would watch it that you weren't even, you know, you weren't telling them about it. And I think that was true when there were less people uploading. But I think now, you know, as more and more people are uploading their content, it is really hard to get your stuff seen. I mean, we put stuff out as the Daily Reel, you know, when our business is online video, and we have a hard time getting eyeballs to it sometimes. And, you know, as it just multiplies exponentially, I don't think that you can rely on that. And I think, you know, everyone's kind of trying to figure out, how can I get my stuff seen? And that is, I think, why we're all in this room right now. And I think, you know, if you're someone like the Four-Eyed Monsters creators, you kind of hit a critical mass, and part of it is luck for sure. But I think that, you know, there's a more sophisticated way to promote your stuff, and it's not always just putting it out there.
And basically what we have, I think, on this panel is three different strategies for the content. I know on our site, What we've done is we've put a lot of mainstream movie reviews and mainstream movie news on the site, and we're kind of like, you know, springing the short films on people, because I don't know that there's necessarily enough mass of people who do look for the narrative short form, be it wherever it is, if it's on YouTube or wherever it might be. You know, Alex obviously kind of taking an editorial role with the Daily Reel and culling through all those videos to find what's out there. And with Dabble, you're looking more at a community-based aggregator and filter.
Yeah, well, or we index and we don't have any content. So I'm the only person here, I guess, who's not making anything except my own videos. But we just search across all those sites and then let the community filter what they find interesting.
And before I forget, I want to let everyone know that the Daily Reel actually has a series of shorts later today at 2:30 over at the Dobie, if you want to check those out. We have enough time. Let's do a little Q&A. That sounded like fun, didn't it? Hey, a little Q&A. Yes.
Replayability and the quality issue. One reason I think musicians are tolerant of low-quality MP3s is because people listen to the song several times. Mm-hmm. However, a short film, short video is kind of a one-time artifact, and if you have only the low quality version, you've kind of spoiled the possibility of a future experience. And it seems to be that episodic content solves that problem by saying, "Here's a low quality version. If you want to go search for the high quality version, you can find it." So, I mean, I think that video, if the end a goal is to just present something, then you want to have it in as high quality as possible. But if it's an episodic, if you're trying to build a brand, then it seems that it's pretty no-brainer to have a low-quality version on YouTube and other places.
And what do you think of this idea that it is disposable? I mean, is that something that we're making an assumption as content creators and saying, oh, well, people will watch this once? And maybe that's the wrong attitude to go into it with?
I wouldn't say that it was disposable. I just think that's a very natural thing. Most people watch things one time.
And I think the advantage you have with video is that people share it a lot. I mean, if I go to a short film festival and I see a film I like, you know, the odds of me going and finding the DVD and, you know, ever acquiring that and sending it to my friends, I mean, I'm copying it, you know, that doesn't happen. But if I have my video on YouTube and I click share, I mean, that's how things take off, and that's how more people get to enjoy your great movies.
I think that's changing, that people just watch things one time. I think music always had an advantage because there were things like Walkman and Discman and iPods, and now that video can exist on the iPod right alongside the music, I think people now that they carry it with them have the ability to watch it again multiple times, especially if it's the same length as a song.
Any more questions? Did I miss anything? That's
anyone
it. That covered, we covered every
link?
Aspect.
We should start watching some videos up here.
I know. Yeah. I feel like it's a video panel. Like, why are we?
We can
should
do that.
Play video.
We can watch some videos. Sure.
What are some of your guys' favorite content that you check out right now?
Oh, God, Inc.
That's a tough question.
Has anybody seen God, Inc.?
We're actually screening God, Inc. in our program.
Awesome.
Yeah.
It's office politics in heaven. It's great. It's like The Office, and, you know, everyone's catty and ridiculous. Yes. Charlie. I love that video. Shun the non-believer.
I'm actually interested to hear how many people here are filmmakers, short filmmakers? Okay, wow, hi. I'm curious to hear, like, what you guys think about online video and, like, people here who are trying to, you know, get feature deals and to be, like, traditional filmmakers versus, you know, anyone here who's really wants to be a viral video maker.
What are your strategies? Are you doing it online? Yeah. Are you putting those shorts online? Are you doing the festival
circuits? Are you frustrated?
Like, yeah.
I'm sure you are.
You're frustrated, Rachel.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Those guys are great.
That's really good. Yeah.
I think it's just because you're kind of bite-sized society, and that's really not the word. Video is so
about it. And
right.
Watching and hearing like, music, you can walk around and shop and you know, do other things. And of course, multitask. The video commands
right.
So the attention. I think that's why the internet's really, until it becomes more of a television thing, it's going to kind of stay as fart videos.
Why is everyone so down on fart videos today?
They're okay, but you just, I don't want to see them like, I don't want to see that as the main thing. I want to look at other stuff.
Yeah, it was porn and it was fart videos, only you watched them in a little.
Any other comments from any of the filmmakers? Want to discuss what you're doing with your shorts? How many of you are putting short films online?
Are you happy? I mean, do you find that that is something that helps you, or is it something that just is more work than you would really want to do?
I mean, I think the audience is so much, like, I mean, a really good shorts program has such a tiny audience.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, the coolest thing for me about the Nerf show is that I'm getting responses from people overseas, which is, you know, like, who just simply couldn't see my work because it mostly plays at American film festivals. And that's great. It's available to an audience around the world.
Yeah, we're holding a film school at UCLA, and, like, more people have seen the work we put on our website than seen any of our other shows.
Yeah, same. Yeah, same's true for me. Yeah, I've done 3 features now, and the amount of people who watched my web show the first hour of the first day it was online is more than have seen all 3 of my features combined. So, you know, like, it's, yeah. Online or whatever is beautiful when it's full screen and it's okay, but you know, for us to put it online in just a small screen on our Super 35 film. Yeah, but the you just have 2 experiences now instead of 1. You just have a movie theater with a 35 projector and you have your computer at home. It's not like one went away and got replaced by the other. Now you just have multiple options. And I mean, I agree with you. Like, my film showed last night at the Paramount Theater, and that was a great experience to see it projected on a big screen. And I shot it on HD, and it looked great. And, you know, so that's why I'm still doing that, because I still like that experience. But nobody took that away from me when I started making the web show. So you just, you know, you do both things instead of one or the other. Yeah, and also, I mean, I grew up watching cartoons. I didn't grow up appreciating, you know, art house cinema. It's something that you find as your tastes change. And kids who are growing up watching YouTube, you know, don't count them out. Like, they're not going to grow up, and their tastes aren't going to change. It's just what they're watching now. So,
also, maybe for another panel, I'd like your thoughts on. We'll save it for another panel, but that experience of being in the theater and getting that instant feedback and knowing what works and what doesn't work versus putting something online where you may overwhelm get comments from people saying they loved it or they hated it, but you can't gauge what's happening when.
Well, it's a different gauge altogether. Yeah. It's a one-on-one experience with a piece of media is very different than sitting in a room with people. You know, there's an energy that exists in the room that's just, you're not going to have by yourself. And it's always really, I mean, Kissing on the Mouth was a good example, because people who watched it at home on DVD thought it was a very serious film, and people who saw it in a theater with an audience laughed a lot and thought it was a really funny film. And it's, you know, it's the same thing. It's just, something about that energy changes, and something about hearing other people laugh makes you feel like it's okay to laugh. And when you don't have those social cues coming from other people, you just, you know, you're sort of intimately locked in with that content.
Great. All right. Thank you, everyone, for coming, and good luck with your short films.